The guest for this part of Focus 580, Jonathan Elkind. He is an independent energy, environment, and security consultant. He served at one point as director for Russian, Ukrainian, and European affairs with the National Security Council. That was from 1998 until 2001. He also served on the national security staff of Vice President Al Gore. He is also a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. He's here visiting the campus. He gave a talk as part of the Center for Advanced Study Initiative on Globalization yesterday, and today he will be talking at the Friday Forum at the University Y on Wright Street in the heart of the campus. A long-running series of talks that's been going on there for a long time, always on Friday over the noon hour. And they're, of course, open to anyone who would like to attend. If you're interested, you can stop by there. And this morning, for all those people who can't, we are going to discuss essentially the same subject, the one that he'll be talking about at noon, and that is energy security here in the United States. So we're pleased to have him here on the program, and questions, as always, are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being here.
I'm very pleased to be here, pleased to be at U of I, and pleased to be in Champaign-Urbana.
Maybe we could talk a little bit about our energy use in the United States now. I'm sure the thing we'd be focusing on is oil primarily, but perhaps also oil and gas. We're now using energy at a very high rate, and it's certainly, I think, the projections, if you look out 10, 20 years more, the expectation is that our energy use is going to continue to go up.
Well, that's a very important piece of the story that one sees when one looks at the U.S. energy situation. Today, our country uses just a little bit more than 100 quadrillion British thermal units, BTUs, every year. And that is set to grow by in excess of 30% in the next 10 to 15 years. This is part of a global picture that's very, very complicated. We live in a world today where, for transportation in particular, we're heavily dependent on refined oil products and where global oil markets are extremely tight. There's an extremely tight balance between current capacity for production and current demand. And that means that there's volatility and high prices. Mm-hmm. These are challenges that are with us today. And even though there's been a drop in the last couple months of about 25% in the pump price that most Americans are paying, these are challenges that are going to stay with us as long as we continue to use energy quite as intensively and in the same ways that we do today.
Yeah, you just mentioned the fact that just recently there has been a drop in the price of oil. And in response, we've just now heard that OPEC is talking about limiting production because they would like to see they would like to get the price back up.
Well, yeah, that give and take is one that is certainly part of the picture from OPEC's side. And I would say OPEC has struggled through the years of its existence since the 1970s to get right from its vantage point the extent to which high prices are beneficial for the members of the cartel versus the extent to which high prices encourage the use of other energy sources. Now, it's important to note also, David, that when one talks about energy security, one is using a shorthand that's convenient but that is a little bit troubling. Mm-hmm. We actually have, in some respects, different energy systems that, as a composite, affect the health of our economy and our national security position and our environmental security as well. Transportation fuels, I alluded to, that's almost exclusively a petroleum picture. But electricity and the electrical power sector is obviously one where there's a lot more fuel diversity. We have energy security issues around both of those systems. But it's important just to get that fact out on the table from the beginning.
Well, it seems that for the foreseeable future, we will have this very heavy reliance on and heavy demand for oil, and probably as heavy and as serious a demand for natural gas here in the United States. And I think the other thing that we know is that almost no matter what we do to increase domestic production, we're going to rely, at least as far as oil is concerned, we're going to be relying heavily on imports. What is now for anybody's best guess about the potential for increasing domestic production, particularly of oil, but of both oil and natural gas?
Well, that's one of the very important questions that affects our position today. In the last 50 years, the United States has gone from a post-war period where we were not a net importer of crude oil to the period today where on the order of 60% of our petroleum is imported. Is there the opportunity to increase domestic production? Yes, there is some marginal potential to do that. Should those domestic opportunities be tapped into regardless of other policy conflicts? I'm not prepared to say that. There's been a long-running discussion about the future of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. I don't personally understand why one would place an excessive, in my opinion, amount of hope in that particular resource, given the particular protection that that part of the world enjoys under our legal system. But let's pretend you decided you didn't care about the wildlife refuge status. Even so, in the global oil industry, when one starts to do test drilling, somewhere on the order of 30 to 35% of test wells are actually successful and yield commercial quantities of crude oil or gas. So I guess in plain language, what that's called is a crapshoot. Are we willing to deviate from our natural resources protection to engage in a crapshoot? And oh, by the way, one that will have at best a marginal impact on our supply-demand balance? It seems to me that those are some important questions that we need to spend time thinking about. Mm-hmm. I'd also notice there's another kind of dissonance that you see when it comes to what we expect out of the energy industry what kind of environmental quality and other attributes we want out of our lives. I joke with friends about a large sport utility vehicle that I saw in my neighborhood in Silver Spring, Maryland. Big SUV with a Greenpeace bumper sticker on it. And to me, that kind of typifies the habit that we have, unfortunately, of talking out of both sides of our mouths. We want more supply. We want cheaper prices. But, oh, by the way, I don't want an oil platform visible from the beach that I like to go to.
Yeah. One of the things that makes this, maybe more complicated to talk about. When you talk about the potential supplies, is that there may be oil available in certain forms that it's going to take a more unconventional way of extraction. That in the past we would have said economically that's just not feasible. Until the price of oil got to a certain point, the price that we have been seeing lately. Then we're saying, well, now oil is going to be more difficult, more expensive to extract. Now seems more appealing because of the level of the prices. I mean, if you look at increased potential for U.S. production, does that indeed include the oil in these kind of forms that in the past we would say it's not worth doing? And maybe even if we'll toss in there whatever else might be available in North America, for example, because Canada has a significant of these kinds of resources.
Yeah, there's a huge scope for the development of non-traditional petroleum resources. And as you rightly allude, the oil sands in Canada are a classic example of this. The broader point that you're pointing to is that price matters. Price matters across our energy economy in lots of important ways. There is a theory that has gained new currency in energy markets and among energy policymakers, and it's the idea of peak oil. This is based on the work of a geologist by the name of M. King Hubbert, who calculated that at some point early in the current decade, we would pass the point at which global hydrocarbon resources were becoming greater and greater in number, and we would in fact start climbing down the backside of the curve. People in Washington and elsewhere around the energy industry have used this as this idea of passing the peak of oil production as a justification for pretty dire predictions about the health of our energy economy and our economy more broadly. Now, it's undoubtedly the case that today's oil and gas deposits are farther from traditional demand centers, more technically difficult to develop, require huge amounts of capital. So in lots of different respects, today's oil industry is very, very different than it was in the past. But again, you point to the idea of different price points and therefore profitability for different types of deposits under different oil price regimes. As prices go up, as they as one might expect generally to see over the course of the coming couple of decades, there will be new technologies which either hadn't been discovered or that weren't economically feasible under different circumstances. And that will help to extract more of the existing oil and gas reserves that we have. It's a little known fact that far less than half of the oil in many deposits is actually extracted out of the ground. There is a whole discipline within the industry called reservoir management that involves very, very sophisticated computer modeling and physical, chemical interventions, the purpose of which is to pull more of that oil and gas out of the reservoirs below ground. One of the interesting little details now where you end up with a junction between the desire to pull the resources out of the ground and the need to deal with the environmental consequences of petroleum combustion is the reinjection of carbon dioxide into producing reservoirs. That has the effect of potentially storing that carbon dioxide, keeping it out of the atmosphere, avoiding climate change, but also then providing the pressure that is necessary to drive the oil and gas out of the reservoirs.
Well, just specifically for a moment to talk a little bit more about the idea of peak oil. Mm-hmm. On and off, I've had the opportunity to hear people on the program to ask them what they think about it, and I have gotten a lot of different answers, beginning with this: the man who wrote the book, Hubbert's mm-hmm. Peak, when mm-hmm. that got that idea out there, I think, generally. That idea that we know where the oil is. We had a pretty good idea how much there is. The idea that there might be undiscovered oil, it's sort of unlikely that there's a significant amount of oil somewhere out in the world that we don't know about. That's sort of what the way the argument runs. And given that we have a pretty fair idea how much oil there is yet to be extracted, the peak oil people say, we've hit the peak. We maybe have hit the peak or soon to hit the peak of world production, and then it's going to decline. Now, as I say, I've asked different people about this and got different sorts of answers, and some of them have said, sort of as you have said, well, it may be difficult to extract, but that there's significant oil that's still out there that we could get. So they don't buy into the idea of peak oil. You personally, what do you think about that argument that says either we've seen the peak or the peak is close, and then we're going to see a steady and significant decline in world production? We go out, 10, 20, 30, 40 years.
Well, economists that I've talked to about this question emphasize first and foremost that any time you get out beyond the kind of 15, 20-year time horizon in economics, you get onto some pretty thin ice. So that's the cautionary note that I would respond to you with first. Secondly, there are huge resources of hydrocarbons that are currently unrecoverable with today's technology. People talk, you may have heard discussion of methane hydrates, which is a form of methane embedded in a lattice-like physical structure under very high pressure at very low temperatures. One finds methane hydrates in sea bottom deposits in Arctic regions and elsewhere. I don't believe that there is an especially robust estimation of the quantity of methane hydrates that exist. Then comes the question, okay, can one imagine the period in the future where an environmentally acceptable and economically feasible technique is developed for the recovery of those deposits? I can't today. I don't think anybody in the industry can today. But obviously this is something where there is sufficient incentive that people are going to be working very hard on that question. So, I mean, to net-net response to your question, I think that Dr. Hubbard's analysis is deeply, deeply thought-provoking. I don't think that it should bring us to the conclusion that the sky is falling.
Our guest, Jonathan Elkind, is an independent energy, environment, and security consultant. He served as director for Russian, Ukrainian, and European affairs with the National Security Council between 1998 and 2001. He also was an advisor now on the national security staff of Vice President Al Gore. And in addition, he's also a non-resident scholar at the Brookings Institution, Washington, D.C. He'll be giving a talk on this very subject, U.S. energy security, as part of the Friday Forum series at the University Y at noontime today. Anyone who is in and around the campus or Champaign-Urbana who would like to hear him is welcome to go down there. And also here on the show, questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, folks. We do also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. We'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. Here is a call in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah. When do you think our Congress is going to step up to the plate and, you know, get serious about conservation and also the responsibility of the American public? I mean, I did attend your session last night and talked about Europe as being the leader. You're at least, you know, starting to make an effort toward the conservation and efficiency.
Well, okay. Well, I think it's a very important point. The politics of energy are a bit of a sad testimony to the difficulty, the challenges of getting our political system moving on big, complex issues that affect people's pocketbooks and that affect the position of our country, both as a matter of security and also economics and environmental equality. I think that there is an unparalleled opportunity in the coming couple of years to actually move forward U.S. energy policy to enhance U.S. energy security interests. Now, that potential will not be realized if we end up with a bipartisan race to the bottom of policymaking on energy. If the bipartisan consensus in Washington is that all one needs to do is hope for lower gasoline prices and then hope that all those voters will just settle down and go back to other pursuits. Instead, we need to start looking with great care at how we use energy in this country and doing some of the basic things that long, long policy debates have suggested are important to do. Top of the list, we need to look at ways to put a price signal into the marketplace, not through shocks, not through energy taxes or carbon taxes that blow people's pocketbooks and that ruin corporate investment strategies, but rather a stepwise introduction, probably of a carbon tax, which could be phased in a predictable manner over time. I find it to be terribly ironic that our country, which as a matter of national policy on both sides of the aisle, shares the belief that markets generally work and that we should use markets to help move ourselves forward. Nonetheless, when it comes to energy policy, we pretend that pricing doesn't matter at all. I can talk a little bit later about CAFE standards, the automobile efficiency standards. That's another area where it's long, long past time to see some new policy making.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, thanks. The argument has been made, and you've touched on it, that if we looked at all of those things we have that use energy, cars and furnaces and air conditioners and refrigerators and, you know, all of the various things we do that use energy, and made them as energy efficient as possible, and that's certainly doable, that that would significantly reduce our use of energy. How and the administration has been criticized for not paying more attention to the question of energy efficiency. How if we really did that? I mean, if we pushed efficiency to the edge, how much difference would that make in our energy consumption?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think that the criticism of the current administration vis-a-vis energy efficiency on the whole is entirely fair. The comment of our vice president, sadly, was that energy efficiency might be a sign of personal virtue, but is not the basis for sound policymaking. This was his comment back in the early days of the Bush-Cheney administration when he was put in charge by the president of the business of developing energy policy recommendations. So the bent, the bias on the part of certainly the vice president of the United States and many others in the current administration that one could solve a problem through greater production, that bias has been long quite clear. I would give the Bush administration better marks in the recent period for responding to exactly the priority that you've just highlighted, David. Secretary Bodman at the Department of Energy arrived in the waning days of the negotiations over the Energy Policy Act of 2005, EPACT 2005. And I'll comment about that act in a minute, but I think that he, as somebody who is a very capable executive from the energy industry, has really significantly accelerated, under some pressure from Congress, by the way, significantly accelerated the work that the Department of Energy is doing to promulgate new appliance standards for 16 or 18, I've forgotten the number, categories of air conditioners, refrigerators, heaters, et cetera. Now, is this an important element of an effective energy policy for the United States? No question. But remember, if you make the appliances and the other energy-consuming equipment in our economy fantastically expensive, fantastically efficient, but prices remain low, what you'll end up with is a kind of a bounce back. People will see the low prices as an opportunity that they can, and rationally as a matter of economics, should exploit. So you won't really be reducing the energy consumption as much as we need to do in this country. That can only be achieved when people get a signal in the marketplace, and that signal is called a price, that says it is in your interest to find creative ways to conserve on your energy usage. Now, I mean, there's a There's been some very interesting recent polling data that your listeners may be aware of or might be interested to hear about. The Greenberg Quinlan Rosner polling firm based in D.C. Recently polled likely voters. This is earlier this month. And they found that reducing dependence on foreign oil was the number one priority of likely voters, above strengthening relations with allies, reducing the threat of terrorism, securing our borders and ports, and other items that have been very, very much at top of mind in the United States in the last several years. I find this to be very, very important information, and unfortunately a little bit depressing. Our problem isn't foreign oil per se. It is overall energy consumption. In the face of that high energy intensity in our country, we make ourselves vulnerable to what happens in foreign oil markets, or even, as Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Rita demonstrated last year, we're even vulnerable when things happen, unfortunate things happen within our own borders.
Yeah. Well, it would certainly be interesting to go out and follow up on a question like that and to try to ask questions of people aimed at getting at the question of what sort of sacrifices would people be willing to make to reduce our dependence on imported oil? Things like, you know, would you be willing to buy a new car that was more fuel efficient? Do you think that automakers should be required to increase fuel efficiency even if that increases the cost of the car? Mm-hmm. Do you think that for all of our complaining about how much it costs to run our cars and heat and cool our homes, we do pay less for energy than a lot of people in a lot of other places. So it sounds as if you're saying, you know, realistically, not only maybe should we be paying more, but if we were paying more, we would think more about the issue of conservation than we do now. There's got to be some to get if your goal is to reduce our dependence on foreign energy, people got to be willing to do something to get to that goal. And it seems like there's a question about what people would be willing to do to achieve that goal.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And there are important caveats that you have to put down when you talk, as I just was doing, about an instrument like a carbon tax. We have a big, I don't need to tell people in Illinois this, but it's sometimes forgotten by people on the coast, we have a big continent-sized country with continental climate swings. And so there are heating and cooling demands, and there are transportation demands that exist in the U.S. marketplace that don't exist if one is sitting in rural France or in Japan. Mm-hmm. Now, so I'm not suggesting for a moment that you can create an equivalency, an equivalent energy market in the United States that exists in Japan. That won't and shouldn't logically happen. But there are lots of lessons that we can learn from other countries. By the way, in the period since the run-up to the Iraq War, when crude oil prices started to rise in the United States, the percent of difference, therefore the pocketbook pain that was felt in the United States, was substantially different than in many other OECD countries, including Japan and Western Europe, where there is a higher base level energy tax. So when the crude oil prices went up, that didn't end up creating such a proportional additional pain for people's household budgets. Anyway, difficult trade-offs that you're pointing to. To me, this says we need to engage in a serious debate about our energy security over the coming couple of years, because it's high time that we stop making energy policy on the basis of our highway bill.
Mm-hmm. We have several callers here. Been patient. And let's go next to Moultrie County. This caller's on line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm a little fascinated by this. There's one question I have, and I guess that is, and I guess in the overall picture, it's become a short-term thing, but when the Germans were making synthetic oil from coal, was that even economically feasible, or was that a situation where the hierarchy in Germany wanted a war machine that was totally independent of anybody else? The other question or comment I had, I thought was almost hilarious when you said the guy was driving a huge SUV and had a Greenpeace sign on the back of his vehicle. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Well, thank you for your call. I mean, the role of the quest for oil and for fuel in World War II creates a lot of the interesting threads of the history of the global oil industry. But the caller's right to flag the point that synthetic fuels from coal, the Fischer-Tropsch method that was employed by Germany during World War II, was less about the economic optimization of the German economy and more about making sure that they didn't end up without fuel for their tanks. That's the short version of the answer.
All right. Well, let's go to someone in Des Plaines up in the Chicago area, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yes.
My question is concerning oil that's in the world. My readings tell me that there seems to be a lot of interest in the South China Sea, even some countries piling up rocks and creating islands just to say they are within their territory. So it's a two-part question. One is, do you have any information about the potential reserves that might be there, and would that influence your position? And number two, are we headed for major crisis there because of the number of countries that are claiming territorial jurisdiction?
Thank you for your call. I mean, I think that that your question points to an overall issue, which is important if one is talking about U.S. energy security, and that is we have a huge stake as a country in global energy systems where cooperation and commercial participation is accorded higher priority than the actions of individual states pursuing policies which more often than not, when the individual states get involved, their actions are about security interests or political maneuverings rather than the health of global energy markets. The International Energy Agency has done some very interesting research, though, that also relates to your question. If one looks at the three decades between 1971 and 2000, and then looks at the three decades between 2001 and 2030, if you compare production and consumption of hydrocarbons in that period, a couple of just stunning points come across, and this is made very graphic in some of the materials from the International Energy Agency. Number one is nearly a doubling in our annual consumption and production of oil in the three decades ahead. That's on a global basis. And the second point is that only about one-third as much of the production will come from industrialized countries that are members of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD. Why do I raise this in relation to the South China Sea? Because the dynamics you were just pointing to in the South China Sea are specifically about a competition for resources, and they are specifically about the fact that it is increasingly difficult, technically challenging, expensive, and politically complicated also to extract the oil and gas reserves that remain around our globe. And I'm sorry to the caller, I don't have specific data on the potential reserves in the South China Sea.
Understood.
All right. Thank you for the call. Let's go to someone here on a cell phone, somewhere on I-74, I believe. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to make a comment and ask the guest to comment on that. As I drive along 74, I've just noticed that they've taken down the series of Burma-shaped signs, basically blaming foreign oil for our gasoline prices. And I guess what I wanted to say, number one, was that someone, if I were to think about what is the worst thing that's happened to American policy making in the modern era, it would be the use of polls and the use of the results of polls as though they actually meant something and that people believed what they told pollsters. And I'm not sure whether there's a deliberate misleading or whether the questions are not being phrased correctly or what. But it seems to me that if we want to start to handle problems, particularly energy problems and ecological problems, what we need to do is to quit listening to polls, quit taking polls, and to, with the government's help, basically let the market really have an impact on people, make people have to make decisions. Do I want to go to dinner? And if I do I want to eat locally? And things like that. I don't think asking people's opinions on things is very helpful. I think that people react when they feel the actual impact of the policies. And you seem to be indicating some sort of agreement with that, so I'd like you to discuss that a little bit, if you would. Thank you.
All right.
Well, I certainly agree with you that we need to have a national discussion about how we use energy, how much energy we use, and what are the impacts of it. There is, to me, no question about that. Let me give you an example that is an elaboration on that point. Last year, after more than 4 years of very, very intensive policy development and lobbying and work in our Congress, the Energy Policy Act of 2005 was passed. It's an authorization bill that if all of the budgets were filled as it allows for, it could be up to $11.5 billion worth of investments and activities in a variety of different elements of our energy sector. About 2 weeks after the signing of the Energy Policy Act, the 2005 Highway Bill was passed. It authorizes $286 billion in spending. And let's remember some of the great achievements of that highway bill. Remember the bridge to nowhere, the bridge in Ketchikan, Alaska, which will serve 50 inhabitants of I don't know how it's pronounced, Gravina or Gravina Island. That is north of $6 million per resident. I'm trying to point up the very herky-jerky way that we end up making energy policy in our country. I agree fundamentally with the caller that we need to have a serious new wave of discussion about energy in our country. And as we do that, my hope would be that we can remember that there will be no single silver bullet. I've given great emphasis in this discussion today to the importance of price as a driver for conservation. I am personally convinced that we absolutely need to engage in that. That can't be the only element of our national energy policy, however. Our energy security will come from a careful, diversified approach, because no silver bullet exists, and I don't think there will be one.
We have a couple of minutes left, and I have two callers, and I'm sure I won't be able to do both of them. My apologies. We'll only do one, and that one will be Urbana in line two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Hello. I'm somebody who is not technical. I'm not an engineer in any way, but I completely support renewable energies, and I have been for the last couple of years looking into ways to use maybe solar power or wind power or just some sort of clean energy in my, to support the energy use of my house. But it's really not that easy, despite from what I've seen a lot of websites that say, like, this is really easy. You can do this using, like, old refrigerators. You can make solar panels. It never is quite easy enough for me to figure out. So I'm just wondering, and also there are a whole bunch of policy issues, especially in our area in Urbana-Champaign in Illinois, because of there's no buyback program. You know, the company will not buy your energy credits or something like this. Ameren is our energy supplier. So I just wonder if you have an opinion as to why it is so difficult in order to use these clean energies in your house, even if you're somebody who's willing to spend money and time and energy trying to make it work. Okay, I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, well, thanks for the call.
Thanks.
Boy, lots and lots of different elements of what you just asked about. For one thing, as your last comment about the buying back of surplus energy indicates, you need to have the right policy environment. You need to have the right incentives in the marketplace so that people are will, as a matter of enlightened self-interest, go ahead and do this. Secondly, there are some really, really everyday challenges that one faces in this regard. My wife and I just finished having some work done in our house. And as we were doing that, we were trying to get the highest efficiency lamping, insulation, doors, windows, et cetera, in the house. And, oh, by the way, a very competent contractor who was doing the work for us simply wasn't that familiar with the products in the marketplace. He's a very honorable person. He just doesn't know those products that well. This also ends up being a part of the picture. In light of the time constraints, I'll just punt by saying that you've alluded to here a very important element of the picture. If there are no silver bullets, there certainly are lots of contributing factors, and an increasing use of renewables, including in our houses, is a perfectly sensible thing that we need to do a lot more of.
Well, we are going to have to stop at this point because we have used the time. I am certain that on future shows we'll get back to many of these issues. But for the moment, we will have to leave it there with our thanks to our guest, Jonathan Elkind. He is an independent energy, environment, and security consultant. He is non-resident senior fellow with the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. from 1998 until 2001. He was director for Russian, Ukrainian, and European Affairs with the National Security Council, and before that also served on the National Security Staff of Vice President Al Gore. If you are in and around Champaign-Urbana and you would like to hear more discussion of these issues, he will be giving a talk on the subject, U.S. Energy Security, at the Friday Forum. That's at the University Y on South Wright on the campus. Anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome. It's open to the public. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
We appreciate it.